timber smoke eddied from their central smoke holes, and even from the height and distance he could make out the African boys tending small groups of humped cattle, and women bent over their garden patches. This, he thought, is African Africa at last. It must have looked much the same when the Impis of Mzilikazi, founder of the Matabele nation, marched north to escape the wrath of Chaka Zulu, to cross the Limpopo and found the kingdom of the people of the long shields. The road bucked and twisted down the bluff and into the Mutseki. Across the valley was another range of hills, and in the centre a deep cleft through which the road ran. This was the gap, the devil's gap, the Duivelskloof. 10 minutes later they were into the gap and cruising slowly past the new primary school and down Buerta Avenue, the principal street of the small township. "Where do you want to go?" asked Fulyun. "When old farmer Marais died, he must have left a will," mused Preston, "and that would have to be executed, and that means a lawyer. Can we find out if there is a lawyer in Duivelskloof, and if he's there on a Saturday morning?" Fulyun drew into the forecourt of Kirsten's garage and pointed across the road at the Imp Inn. "Go and have a coffee and order one for me. I'll tank up and ask around." He rejoined Preston in the hotel lounge 5 minutes later. "There's one lawyer," he said as he sipped his coffee. "He's an Anglo, name of Benson. It's right across the street, 2 doors from the garage, and he'll probably be in this morning. Let's go." Mr. Benson was in. Fulyun flashed a card in a plastic wallet at his secretary, which had an immediate effect. She talked in Afrikaans into an intercom, and they were shown without delay into the office of Mr. Benson, a friendly and rubicund man in a fawn suit. He greeted them both in Afrikaans. Fulyun replied in his heavily accented English. "This is Mr. Preston. He's come from London, England. He wishes to ask you some questions." Mr. Benson bade them be seated and resumed his chair behind the desk. "Please," he gestured, "anything I can do?" "Can you tell me how old you are?" asked Preston. Benson gazed at him in amazement. "All the way from London to ask how old I am? As a matter of fact, I'm 53. So in 1946 you would have been 12. "Yes. Can you tell me, please, who's the lawyer here in Duivelskloof in that year?" "Certainly. My father, Cedric Benson."
"Is he alive?"
"Yes. He's over 80, and he handed over to me 15 years ago. But he's pretty spry."
"Would it be possible to talk to him?"
For answer, Mr. Benson reached for a telephone and dialed a number. His father must have answered, for the son explained there were visitors, one from London, who would like to talk to him. He replaced the receiver. "He lives about 6 miles away, but he still drives, to the terror of all other road users. He says he'll be here directly." "In the interim," asked Preston, "could you consult your files for the year 1946 and see if you, or rather your father, executed the will of a local farmer, one Lawrence Moray, who died in January of that year?"
"I'll try," said Benson Jr.
"Of course, this Mr. Murray may have been with a lawyer from Petersburg, but local people tended to stay local in these days. The 1946 box must be around somewhere. Excuse me." He left the office. The secretary served coffee. 10 minutes later, there were voices in the outer office. The two Bensons entered together, the son carrying a dusty cardboard box. The old man had a fuzz of white hair and looked as alert as a young kestrel. After the introductions, Preston explained his problem. Without a word, the older Benson took the chair behind the desk, forcing his son to draw up another one. Old Benson placed glasses on his nose and gazed at the visitors over them.
"I remember Lawrence Moray," he said, "and yes, we did handle his will when he died. I did it myself."
The son passed him a dusty and faded document tied in pink ribbon. The old man blew the dust off it, untied the ribbon, and spread it out. He began to read it silently.
"Ah, yes, I remember it now. He was a widower, lived alone, had one son, Jan. A tragic case. The boy had just come back from the Second World War. Lawrence Moray was going down to Cape Town to visit him when he died. Tragic."
"Can you tell me about the bequests?" asked Preston.
"Everything to the son," said Benson simply. "Farm, house, equipment, contents of house. Oh, the usual small bequests in money to the native farm workers, foremen, and that sort of thing."
"Any personal bequests? Anything of a personal nature?" persisted Preston.
"One here. To my old and good friend, Huub van Rensburg, my ivory chess set in memory of the many contented evenings we spent playing together at the farm. That's all.
Was the son back home in South Africa when the father died? Asked Preston.
Must have been. Old Lawrence was going down to see him. A long trip in these days. No airliners then. One went by train.
Did you handle the sale of the farm and the other property, Mr. Benson?
The auctioneers did the sale, right out of the farm. It went to the Van Zyls. They bought the lot. All the land belongs to Bertie Van Zyl now, but I was there as chief executor of the will.
Were there any personal memorabilia that did not sell? Asked Preston.
The old man furrowed his brow. Not much. It all went. Oh, I recall there was a photograph album. It had no commercial value. I believe I gave it to Meneer van Rensburg.
Who was he?
The schoolmaster, cut in the son. He taught me, until I went to Marensky High. He ran the old farm school until they built the primary school. Then he retired, here in Duivelskloof.
Is he still alive?
No, he died about 10 years ago, said the elder Benson. I went to the funeral.
But there is a daughter, said his son helpfully. Sissy. She was at Marensky with me. Must be the same age.
Do you know what happened to her?
Certainly. She married years ago, a sawmill owner out in the Tzanin Road.
One last question. Preston addressed himself to the old man. Why did you sell up the property? Didn't the son want it?
Apparently not, said the old man. He was in the Weinberg Military Hospital at the time. He sent me a cable. I got his address from the military authorities, and they vouched for his identity. The cable asked me to realize the entire estate and cable the money to him.
He did not come for the funeral.
No time. January is our summer month in South Africa. In those days there were few morgue facilities. Bodies had to be buried without delay. In fact, I don't think he ever returned at all. Understandable. With his father gone, there was nothing to come back for.
Where is Lawrence Murray buried?
In the graveyard up on the hill, said Benson Senior.
Is that all?
Then I'll be off to my lunch.
The climate east and west of the mountains at Duivelskloof varies dramatically. West of the range, the rainfall in the Mutseki is about 20 inches a year. East of the range, the great clouds beat up from the Indian Ocean, drift across Mozambique and the Kruger Park, and butt into the mountains, whose eastern slopes are drenched with 80 inches of rain a year. On this side, the industry comes from the forests of blue gum trees. 6 miles up the Tzanin Road, Fillion and Preston found the sawmill of Mr. de Plessy. It was his wife, the schoolmaster's daughter, who opened the door, a plump, apple-cheeked woman of about 50, with flour on her hands and apron. She was in the throes of baking. She listened to their problem intently, then shook her head.
I remember as a small girl going out to the farm and him playing chess with Farmer Murray, she said. That would be about 1944 and 1945. I recall the ivory chess set, but not the album.
When your father died, did you not inherit his effects? Asked Preston.
No, said Mrs. du Plessy. You see, my mother died in 1955, leaving Daddy a widower. I looked after him myself until I married in 1958, when I was 23. After that, he couldn't cope. His house was always a mess. I tried to keep going to cook and clean for him, but when the children came, it was too much. Then in 1960, his sister, my aunt, was widowed in her turn. She had lived at Petersburg. It made sense for her to come and live with my father and look after him, so she did. When he died, I had already asked him to leave it all to her, the house, furniture, and so forth.
What happened to the aunt? Asked Preston.
Oh, she still lives there. It's a modest bungalow just behind the Imp Inn back at Duivelskloof.
She agreed to accompany them. Her aunt, Mrs. Winter, was at home, a bright, sparrow-like lady with blue-rinsed hair. When she had heard them, she went to a cupboard and pulled out a flat box.
"Poor Yoop used to love playing with this," she said. It was the ivory chess set. "Is this what you want?"
"Not quite. It's more the photograph album," said Preston. She looked puzzled.
"There is a box of old junk up in the loft," she said. "It went up there after he died. Just papers and things from his schoolmastering days."
Andres Fulyun went up to the attic and brought it down. At the bottom of the yellowed school reports was the Murray family album. Preston leafed through it slowly. It was all there, the frail, pretty bride of 1920, the shyly smiling mother of 1930, The frowning boy astride his first pony, the father with pipe clamped in teeth, trying not to look too proud, with his son by his side and a row of rabbits on the grass in front of them. At the end was a monochrome photo of a boy in cricket flannels, a handsome lad of 17, coming up to the wicket to bowl. The caption said, "Yonny, captain of cricket, Morensky High, 1943. It was the last entry. "May I keep this?" said Preston.
"Certainly," said Mrs. Vinther.
"Did your late brother ever talk to you about Mr. Murray?"
"Sometimes," she said. "They were very good friends for many years."
"Did he ever say what he died of?" She frowned. "Didn't they tell you at the lawyer's office? Old Cedric must be losing his wits. It was a hit-and-run accident, Thup told me. It seems old Murray had stopped to repair a puncture, and he was hit by a passing truck. At the time it was thought to be some drunken Kaffirs. Whoops!" Her hand flew to her mouth, and she looked at Fulian with embarrassment. "I'm not supposed to say that any more. Well, anyway, they never found out who was driving the truck."
On the way back down the hill to the main road, they passed the graveyard. Preston asked Fulian to stop. It was a pleasant, quiet plot, high above the town, fringed by pine and fir, dominated in its centre by an old mwataba tree with a cleft trunk, and enclosed by a hedge of poinsettia. In one corner they found a moss-covered stone. Scraping away the moss, Preston found the motto carved in the granite. Lawrence Murray, 1879-1946, beloved husband of Mary and father of Jan. Always with God. R.I.P.
Preston strolled across to the hedge, plucked a sprig of flaming poinsettia, and laid it by the stone. Fulian looked at him oddly.
"Pretoria, I think," said Preston.
As they were climbing the Buffelberg on the road out of the Mutseki, Preston turned to look across the valley. Dark grey storm clouds had built up behind the Devil's Gap. As he watched, they closed in, blotting out the little town and its macabre secret, known only to a middle-aged Englishman in a retreating car. Then he put his head back and fell asleep. That evening, Harold Filby was escorted from the guest suite to the sitting room of the General Secretary, where the Soviet leader awaited him. Filby laid several documents in front of the old man. The General Secretary read them and laid them down. "There are not many people involved," he said. "Permit me to make two important points, Comrade General Secretary. First, because of the extreme confidentiality of Plan Aurora, I have thought it wise to keep the number of participants to an absolute minimum. On a need-to-know basis, even fewer would know what is really intended. Secondly, and yet conversely, because of the extreme shortness of time, there will have to be some cutting of corners. The weeks, even months, of briefing habitually required for an important active measure will have to be telescoped into days." The General Secretary nodded slowly. "So explain why you need these men." "The key to the whole operation," Philby continued, "is the executive officer, the man who will actually go into Britain and live there for weeks as a Britisher, and who will finally carry out Aurora. Supplying him with what he needs will be 12 couriers, or mules. They will have to smuggle the items in, either through a customs point or, on occasion, through an unchecked entry point. Each will know nothing of what he is carrying or why. Each will have memorized a rendezvous and another as fallback in case of a non-connect. Each will hand over the package to the executive officer, and then return to our territory to pass immediately into total quarantine. There will be one other man, apart from the executive officer, who will never return, but neither of these men should know this. Commanding the couriers will be the dispatching officer with responsibility to ensure that the consignments reach the executive officer in Britain. He will be supported by a procurement supply officer charged with procuring the packages for delivery. This man will have four subordinates, each with one speciality. One will furnish the courier's documentation and transportation. Another will concern himself with obtaining the high technology. The third will provide the milled and engineered artifacts, and the fourth will assure communications. It will be vital that the executive officer can inform us of progress, problems, and above all, of the moment he is operationally ready, and we must be able to inform him of any change of
plan, and of course give him the order to execute the plan. In the matter of communications, there is one more thing to say. Because of the time element, it will not be possible to proceed through normal channels of mailed letters or personal meetings. We can communicate with the executive officer by coded Morse signals sent on Radio Moscow's commercial wave bands using one-time pads. But for him to reach us urgently, he is going to need a transmitter somewhere in Britain. It's old-fashioned and risky, mainly intended for use in time of war, but it will have to be. You will see I have made mention of it. The General Secretary studied the documents again, identifying the executives that the plan would need. Finally, he looked up. "You'll get your men," he said. "I will have them traced one by one, the very best we have, and transferred to special duties. One last thing. I do not wish anyone concerned with Aurora to make contact of any form with the KGB people inside our residentura at the embassy in London. One never knows who is under surveillance, or whatever his other fear, he left it unsaid. That is all."
Chapter 10. Preston and Fulyun convened in their office on the third floor of Union Building the next morning at the Englishman's request. As it was a Sunday, they had the block almost to themselves. "Well, what next?" asked Captain Fulyun.
"I lay awake last night thinking," said Preston, "and there's something that doesn't fit."
"You slept all the way back from the north," said Fulyun grimly. "I had to drive."
"Ah, but you're so much fitter," said Preston.
That pleased Fulyun, who was proud of his physique, which he exercised regularly. He unbent somewhat.
"I want to trace the other soldier," said Preston.
"What other soldier?"
"The one Marais escaped with. He never mentioned his name, just the other soldier, or my comrade. Why doesn't he give him a name?"
Fulyun shrugged. "He must have told the authorities at the Weinberg Hospital so the next of kin could be informed."
"That was verbal," mused Preston. "The officers who heard him would soon have scattered into civilian life. Only the written record remains, and it mentions no name. I want to trace the other soldier."
"But he's dead," protested Fulyun. "He's been in a grave in the Polish forest for 42 years.
"Then I want to find out who he was."
"Where the hell do we start?"
"Marais says they kept alive in that camp, mainly by Red Cross food parcels," Preston said, as if thinking aloud. "He also says they escaped just before Christmas.
That would have upset the Germans a bit. It was usual for the whole block to be punished. Loss of privileges, including food parcels. Everyone in the block would be likely to remember that Christmas for the rest of their lives. Can we find someone who is in that block?"
There is no former Prisoners of War Association in South Africa, but there is a brotherhood of war veterans, confined to those who have actually been in combat. It is called the Memorable Order of Tin Hats, and its members are known as Moths. Each Moth branch meeting room is called a shell hole, and the commanding officer is the Old Bill. Using a telephone each, Preston and Fulyun began to call up every shell hole in South Africa, trying to find anyone who was in Stalag 344. It was a wearying task. Of the 11,000 Allied prisoners in that camp, the great bulk were from Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, or America. The South Africans were a minority. Moreover, in the intervening years, many had died. Of the Moths, some were out on the golf links, others away from home. They got regretful disclaimers and a host of helpful suggestions that turned out to be blind alleys. They broke for the day at sundown and started again on the Monday morning. Fulyun got his break just before noon. It came in the form of a retired meat packer in Cape Town. Fulyun, who was speaking in Afrikaans, put his hand over the receiver.
"Guy here says he was in Stalag 344.
Preston took over. "Miss Anderson? Yes, my name is Preston. I'm doing some research about Stalag 344. Thank you. Very kind. Yes, I believe you are there. Do you remember Christmas 1944? Two young South African soldiers escaped from an outside work party."
"Ah, you do recall it.
Yes, I'm sure it was pretty awful. Do you recall their names?"
"Ah, not in their hut. No, of course.
Well, do you remember the name of the senior South African NCO? Good.
Warrant Officer Roberts. Any first name? Please try to remember. What? Wally. You're sure of that? Many thanks indeed.
Preston put the phone down. Warrant Officer Wally Roberts, probably Walter Roberts. Can we go to the military archive?
The South African military archive is found, for some reason, under the Department of Education and is seated beneath 20 Visakhi Street, Pretoria. There were over 100 Roberts listed, 19 of them with the initial W, and 7 called Walter. None fitted. They went through the rest of the W Roberts. Nothing. Preston started with the A Roberts files, and was lucky 1 hour later. James Walter Roberts had been a warrant officer in the Second World War, captured at Tobruk and imprisoned in North Africa, Italy, and finally Eastern Germany. He had stayed on in the army after the war and risen to the rank of colonel, retiring in 1972.
"You'd better pray he's still alive," said Fulian.
"If he is, he'll be drawing a pension," said Preston. "The pensions people might have him." They did. Colonel retired, Wally Roberts, was spending the autumn of his life at Orangeville, a small town set amid lakes and forests 100 miles south of Johannesburg. It was dark out on Visakhi Street when they emerged. They decided to drive down the next morning. It was Mrs. Roberts who opened the door of the neat bungalow and examined Captain Fulune's identity card with flustered alarm.
"He's down by the lake feeding the birds," she told them, and pointed out the path.
They found the old warrior distributing morsels of bread to a grateful flock of water birds. He straightened up when they approached and examined Fulune's card. Then he nodded, as if to say, "Carry on." He was in his 70s, ramrod erect, in tweeds and highly polished brown shoes, a bristle of white across the upper lip. He listened gravely to Preston's question.
"Certainly I remember. I was hauled up before the German commandant, who was in the devil of a rage. The whole hut lost the Red Cross parcels for that episode. Damned young fools. We were evacuated westwards on the 22nd of January 1945 and liberated in late April."
"Do you remember their names?" asked Preston.
"Certainly. Never forget a name. Both were young, late teens, I should think. Both were corporals. One was called Marais, the other was Brandt, Freaky Brandt. Both Afrikaners. Can't recall their units, though. We were all so muffled up, wearing whatever we could. Hardly ever saw regimental flashes."
They thanked him profusely and drove back to Pretoria for another session at Visakhi Street. Unfortunately, Brandt is a very common Dutch name, with its variation, Brandt, which lacks the terminal T but is pronounced the same. There were hundreds of them. By nightfall, with the aid of the archive staff, they had culled 6 Corporal Frederick Brandts, all deceased. 2 had died in action in North Africa, 2 in Italy, and 1 in a capsized landing craft. They opened the 6th file. Captain Fulune stared wide-eyed at the open file.
"I don't believe it," he said softly. "Who could have done it?"
"Who knows?" Preston replied. "But it was a long time ago. The file was completely empty."
"I'm sorry about that," said Fulune as he drove Preston back to the Burgerspark. "But it looks like the end of the trail."
Late that evening, from his hotel room, Preston called Colonel Roberts. "Sorry to trouble you again, Colonel. Do you recall at all whether Corporal Brandt had any special mate or friend in that hut? My own experience in the army is that there is usually one close mate."
"Quite right, there usually is. I can't recall offhand. Let me sleep on it. If I think of anything, I'll call you in the morning."
The helpful Colonel called Preston over breakfast. The clipped voice came down the line as if he were making a battle sit-rep to headquarters.
"Remember something," he said. "Those huts were built for about 100 men, but we were jammed in there at the end like sardines. Over 200 chaps to a hut. Some slept on the floor, others had to share a bunk. Nothing puffy, you know, just had to be done."
"I understand," said Preston. "And Brandt?"
"Shared a bunk with another corporal, name of Levinson, RDLI.
I beg your pardon?
Royal Durban Light Infantry, Levinson was."
Visakhi Street came up faster this time. Levinson was not nearly so common a name, and they had a regiment. The file was out in 15 minutes. His name was Max Levinson, and he had been born in Durban. He had quit the army at the end of the war, so there was no pension and no address, but they knew he was 65 years old. Preston tried the Durban telephone directory, while Fulune had Durban police run up the name through their files. Fulune came up first.
There were two parking tickets and an address. Max Levinson ran a small hotel on the seafront. Villian called and got Mrs. Levinson. She confirmed her husband had been in Stalag 344. At the moment, he was out fishing. They twiddled their thumbs until he came back at nightfall. Then Preston spoke to him. The cheerful hotelier boomed down the line from the east coast.
"Sure, I remember Freaky. Silly bastard did a runner into the woods. Never did hear of him again. What about him?"
"Where did he come from?" asked Preston.
"East London,"
said Levinson without hesitation. "What was his background?"
"Never said much about it," replied Levinson. "Afrikaner, of course. Fluent Afrikaans, poor English, working class. Oh, I remember, he said his dad was a shunter in the railway yards there."
Preston made his goodbyes and turned to Fulian. "East London," he said. "Can we drive there?" Fulian sighed.
"I wouldn't advise it," he said. "It's hundreds of miles. We're a very big country, Mr. Preston. If you really want to go, we'll go by plane tomorrow. I'll arrange a police car and driver to meet us."
"Unmarked car, please," said Preston. "Driver in plain clothes."
Although the headquarters of the KGB is at the centre, at number 2 Dzerzhinsky Square in central Moscow, and though the building is not small, it is far too crammed to contain even a proportion of one of the chief directorates, and departments that make up this huge organisation. So the sub-headquarters are scattered all over. The first chief directorate is based at Yasyenovo, on the outer ring road around Moscow, almost due south of the city. Almost all the FCD is housed in a modern aluminium and glass seven-story edifice shaped in the form of a three-pointed star, rather like the logo of Mercedes cars. It was built by the Finns on contract, and was intended for the International Department of the Central Committee, but when it was finished, the ID people did not like it. They wanted to stay close to central Moscow, so it was given to the FCD. It suits the first chief directorate admirably, being well out of town and away from prying eyes. Staffers of the FCD are officially undercover, even in their own country, as many of them will have to go abroad, or already have been, posing as diplomats. The last thing they need is to be seen coming out of FCD headquarters by a nosy tourist who might put them on candid camera. But there is one directorate within the FCD that is so secret it is not even based with the rest at Yasyenovo. If the FCD is secret, the S, or Illegals Directorate, within it is top secret. Not only do its agents not meet their fellow FCD colleagues, they do not even meet each other. Their training and briefing are on a one-to-one basis, just the instructor and one pupil. They do not check in each morning to any office, since that way they would see each other. The reason is simple in Soviet psychology. Russians are paranoid about secrecy and betrayal. There is nothing particularly communist about this. It goes back to Tsarist days. The illegals are men, and occasionally women, who are rigorously trained to go into foreign countries and live under deep cover. Yet illegals have been caught and have cooperated with their captors. Others have defected and spilled all they knew. Therefore, the less they know, the better. It is axiomatic in espionage that one cannot betray what or whom one does not know. The illegals, therefore, are boarded out in scores of small flats in central Moscow and report singly for training and briefing. In order to be close to his lads, the director of the S Directorate still keeps his office at the centre on Dzerzhinsky Square. It is on the 6th floor, 3 stories above Chairman Chebrikov, and 2 above his first deputy chairman, Generals Tsinev and Kryuchkov. It was to this unpretentious sanctum that 2 men came on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 18th of March, while Preston was talking to Max Levinson, to confront the director of the illegals, a seamy old veteran who had been in clandestine espionage all his adult life. What they presented to him did not please him.
"There is only one man who fits this bill," he grudgingly admitted. "He is outstanding."
One of the men from the Central Committee offered a small card. "Then, Comrade Major General, you will detach him from his duties forthwith and require him to report to this address." The director nodded glumly. He knew the address. When the men had gone, he recalled their authorization again. It was from the Central Committee, all right. And though it did not say so in as many words, he had no doubt from whom it came with that kind of authority rating. He sighed resignedly. It was hard to lose one of the best men he'd ever trained,
a really exceptional agent, but there was no arguing with that particular order. He was a serving officer. It was not for him to question orders. He depressed a switch on his intercom. "Tell Major Valeri Pietrovsky to report to me," he said. The first plane out of Johannesburg for East London arrived on time at Benskuman, the small, neat, blue-and-white airport which serves South Africa's fourth commercial port and city. The police driver was waiting in the concourse and led them to a plain Ford saloon in the parking lot. "Where to, Captain?" he asked. Viljoen raised an eyebrow at Preston. "The railway headquarters," said Preston. "More particularly, the administration building." The driver nodded and set off. East London's modern railway station is on Fleet Street, and directly opposite stands a rather shabby old complex of single-story buildings in green and cream, the administration offices. Inside, Fulune's Open Sesame identity card brought them quickly to the director of the finance department. He listened to Preston's query.
"Yes, we do pay pensions to all retired railway staff still living in this area," he said. "What was the name?"
"Brandt," said Preston. "I'm afraid I don't have a first name, but he was a shunter many years ago." The director summoned an assistant, and they all trooped down dingy corridors to the records office. The assistant burrowed for a while and came up with a pension slip. "Here he is," he said. "The only one we have. Retired 3 years ago. Koos Brandt." "How old would he be?" asked Preston. 63, said the assistant after a glance at the card. Preston shook his head. If Fricky Brandt had been the same age as Jan Marais, and his father about 30 years older, the old man would be over 90. "And the man I seek would be about 90 by now," he said. The director and his assistant were adamant there were no other retired Brandts. "Then can you find me," asked Preston, "the three oldest pensioners still alive and in receipt of their weekly pension?"
"They're not listed by age," protested the assistant. "They're listed alphabetically."
Viljoen drew the director aside and spoke urgently in his ear in Afrikaans. Whatever he said had its effect. The director looked impressed. "Go ahead," he told his assistant. "One by one, anyone born before 1910 will be in my office." It took an hour. The assistant produced three pension slips.
"There's one of 90," he said, "but he was a porter at the passenger terminal. One of 80, a former cleaner. This one is 81. He's a former shunter from the marshalling yards."
The man was called Fourie, and his address was given as somewhere up in Quigny. 10 minutes later, they were driving through the Quigny, the old quarter of East London, dating back 50 years and more. Some of its humble bungalows had been done up, others were shabby and run down, the homes of the poorer white working class. From behind Moore Street, they could hear the clang of the railway workshops and the shunting yards, where the big trains are assembled to haul freight from the docks of East London up to the landlocked Transvaal via Bloemfontein. They found the house one block off Moore Street. An old coloured woman answered the door, face like a pickled walnut and white hair drawn back in a bun. Viljoen spoke to her in Afrikaans. The old woman pointed towards the horizon and muttered something before firmly closing the door. Viljoen escorted Preston back to the car. "She says he's up at the Institute," Viljoen told the driver. "Know what she means?"
"Yes, sir. The old Railway Institute. Now they call it Turnbull Park, up Paterson Street. It's the social and recreation club for railway workers."
It turned out to be a large single-story building set in a walled car park adjacent to its own three bowling greens. Through the doors they passed an array of snooker tables and TV lounges before arriving at a flourishing bar.
"Papa Fourie," said the barman. "Sure, he's out there watching the bowling."
They found the old man by one of the greens, sitting in the warm autumn sunshine, nursing a pint of beer. Preston put his question. The old man stared at him for a while before nodding.
"Yes, I remember Joe Brandt. He's been dead these many years."
"He had a son, Frederick, or Fricky."
"That's right. Good heavens, young man, you're taking me back quite a bit. Nice kid. He used to come down to the yard sometimes after school. Joe used to let him ride the shunting locos with him. Quite a treat for a lad in those days."
"That would be in the mid to late 1930s, asked Preston. The old man nodded.
"About then, just after Joe and his family came here.
Around 1943, the boy Fricky went away to the war," said Preston. Papa Fourie stared at him for a while from rheumy eyes that were trying to look backwards through more than 50 years of uneventful life.
That's right, he said. The boy never came back. They told Joe he had died somewhere in Germany. It broke Joe's heart. He doted on that boy, had great plans for him. He was never the same, not after that telegram arrived at the end of the war. He died in 1950, I always reckoned, of a broken heart. His wife wasn't long after him, a couple of years, perhaps.
You said just now, just after Joe and his family came here, Fulyun reminded him. Which part of South Africa did they come from? Papa Fourie looked puzzled.
They didn't come from South Africa, he said.
They were an Afrikaner family, repeated Fulyun.
Who told you that?
The army, said Fulyun. The old man smiled.
I suppose young Frikkim would have passed himself off as an Afrikaner in the army, he said. No, they came from Germany, immigrants, about the middle of the 30s. Joe never spoke good Afrikaans to the day he died. Of course the boy did, learned at school.
When they were back in the parked car, Fulyun turned to Preston and asked,
Well?
Where are the records of the immigration people kept in South Africa?
In the basement of the Union Building, along with the rest of the state archives, said Fulyun.
Could the archivists up there run a check for me while we wait here? Asked Preston.
Sure. Let's go to the police station. We can phone better from there. The police station is also on Fleet Street, a three-floor yellow brick fortress with opaque windows, right next to the drill hall of the Kaffrarian Rifles. They put in their request and lunch in the canteen, while up in Pretoria an archivist lost his lunch hour while he went through the files. Happily, they had all been computerized, and the file number came up quickly. The archivist withdrew the file, typed up a resume, and put it on the telex. In East London, the telex was brought to Preston and Fulyun over coffee. Fulyun translated it word for word.
Good God, he said when he had finished it. Who would ever have thought it?
Preston seemed pensive. He rose and crossed the canteen to speak to the driver, who was at a separate table.
Is there a synagogue in East London?
Yes, sir, in Park Avenue, 2 minutes from here.
The white-painted, black-domed synagogue, surmounted by the Star of David, was empty on a Thursday afternoon, save for a coloured caretaker in an old army greatcoat and wool bonnet. He gave them the address of Rabbi Bloom in the suburb of Salbon. They knocked on his door just after 3 o'clock. He opened it himself, a stalwart, bearded man in his mid-50s, with iron-grey hair. One glance was enough. He was too young. Preston introduced himself. Can you tell me, please, who was the rabbi here before yourself?
Certainly, Rabbi Shapiro.
Have you any idea if he is still alive and where I might find him?
You'd better come in, said Rabbi Bloom.
He led the way into his house, down a corridor, and opened a door at the end. The room was a bedsitter, in which a very old man sat before a gas fire, sipping a cup of black tea.
Uncle Solomon, there's someone here to see you, he said.
Preston left the house an hour later and rejoined Fulyun, who had returned to the car.
The airport, Preston told the driver, and to Fulyun,
could you arrange a meeting with General Pinard tomorrow morning? That afternoon, two more men were transferred from their posts in the Soviet armed forces to special assignment. West of Moscow, about 100 miles, just off the road to Minsk and set in a large forest, is a complex of radio dish aerials and supporting buildings. It is one of the USSR's listening posts for radio signals coming in from Warsaw Pact military units and from abroad, but it can also listen into messages between other parties far outside the Soviet borders. One section of the complex is screened off and is solely for KGB use. One of the men was a warrant officer radio operator from his section.
"He's the best man I've got," complained the commanding colonel to his deputy when the men from the Central Committee had left. "Good. I'll say he's good. Given the equipment, he can pick up a cockroach scratching its arse in California."
The other posted man was a colonel in the Soviet Army, and if he were in uniform, which he seldom was, his flashes would indicate he was with the artillery. In fact, he was more scientist than soldier, and worked in the Directorate of Ordnance, Research Division.
"So," said General Pinard, when they were seated round the coffee table in the leather-clubbed chairs, "our diplomat, Jan Marais, is he guilty or not?"
"Guilty," said Preston,
as hell. I think I'd like to hear you prove that, Mr. Preston. Where did he go wrong? Where was he turned? He didn't, and he wasn't, said Preston. He never put a foot wrong. You have read his handwritten autobiography? Yes, and as Captain Fulion may have pointed out, we too have checked everything in that man's career from birth to the present day. We can find not one discrepancy.
There aren't any, said Preston.
The story of his boyhood is absolutely accurate to the last detail. I believe he could even today describe that boyhood for 5 hours without repeating himself once, and without being wrong in a single detail. Then it's true. Everything that is checkable is true, said the General. Everything that is checkable, yes. It is all true up to the point when those two young soldiers dropped from the tailboard of a German lorry in Silesia and started running. After that, it's all lies. Let me explain by starting at the other end. The man who jumped with Jan Marais. The story of Fricky Brandt. In 1933, Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany. In 1935, a German railway worker called Josef Brandt went to the South African legation in Berlin and pleaded for an immigration visa on compassionate grounds, that he was in danger of persecution because he was a Jew. His appeal was heard, and he was granted a visa to emigrate to South Africa with his young family. Your own archives confirm the application and the issue of the visa. That's right, nodded General Pinard. There were many Jewish immigrants to South Africa during the Hitler period. South Africa has a good record on that issue, better than some. In September 1935, continued Preston, Josef Brandt, with his wife Ilse and his 10-year-old son Friedrich, boarded ship at Bremerhaven, and 6 weeks later disembarked at East London. There was then a large German community and a small Jewish one there. He elected to stay, and sought a job on the railways. A kindly immigration official informed the local rabbi of the arrival of the new family. The rabbi, an energetic young man called Solomon Shapiro, visited the newcomers and tried to help by encouraging them to join in the Jewish community life. They refused, and he assumed they wished to try to assimilate into the Gentile community. He was disappointed, but not yet suspicious. Then, in 1938, the boy, now Afrikanerized into Frederick or Fricky, turned 13. It was time for his bar mitzvah, the coming of age for a Jewish boy. However the Brants might wish to assimilate, that is an important thing for a man with an only son. Although none of them had ever been to shul, Rabbi Shapiro visited the family to ask if they would like him to officiate. They gave him a flea in his ear, and his suspicions hardened into certainty. "What certainty?" asked the General, perplexed. "The certainty that they were not Jewish," said Preston. "He told me last night. At a bar mitzvah, the boy is blessed by the rabbi. First, the rabbi must be convinced of the boy's Jewishness. The mother must produce a document, called a ketuvah, confirming that her marriage was solemnized in a synagogue according to the Jewish faith. Ilse Brandt had no ketuvah. There could be no bar mitzvah." "So they entered South Africa on false pretenses," said General Pinard. "It was a hell of a long time ago."
"More than that," said Preston.
"I can't prove it, but I think I'm right. Josef Brandt was correct when he told your legation all those years ago that he was under threat from the Gestapo. But not as a Jew. As a militant, activist, German communist. He knew if he told your legation that, he'd never get a visa." "Go on," said the General grimly. "By the time he was 18, his son, Fricky, was completely imbued with his father's secret ideals. A dedicated communist, prepared to work for the Comintern. In 1943, two young men joined the South African army and went to war. Jan Marais, from Duivelskloof, to fight for South Africa and the British Commonwealth, and Fricky Brandt, to fight for his ideological motherland, the Soviet Union. They never met in basic training, or on the troop convoy, or in Italy, or at Moosburg, but they met at Stalag 344, I don't know whether Brandt had worked out his escape plans by then, but he picked for his companion a young man, tall and blonde, like himself. I believe it was he, not Marais, who initiated that run into the forest when the truck broke down."
"But what about the pneumonia?" asked Fulion.
"There was no pneumonia," said Preston, "nor did they fall into the hands of Catholic Polish partisans. More likely they fell in with the communist partisans, to whom Brandt could talk in fluent German. They would have led them to the Red Army, and thence to the NKVD, with the trusting Marais tailing along.
It was between March and August 1945 that the switch took place. All that talk about freezing cells was rubbish. Murray would have been squeezed for every last detail of his childhood and education, and Brunt would have memorized it until, despite his poor written English, he could write that curriculum vitae with his eyes closed. They probably gave Brunt a crash course in English as well, changing his appearance a bit, putting Murray's dog tag round his neck until finally they were ready. After that, with his usefulness served, the Jan Murray was probably liquidated. They roughed Brunt up a bit, gave him a few chemicals to make him realistically ill, and handed him back at Potsdam. He spent time in a hospital at Bielefeld, and more outside Glasgow. By the winter of 1945, all South African soldiers would have gone home. He was unlikely to run across anyone from the Witz de la Rey regiment. And in December, he sailed for Cape Town, arriving in January 1946. There was one problem. He could not go to Duivelskloof. He had no intention of going. Then someone at Defence HQ sent old farmer Murray a cable to say his son was home at last, having been posted missing, presumed dead. To Brunt's horror, a cable arrived. I admit I'm guessing here, but it makes sense, urging him to return home. He made himself ill again and went into Weinberg Military Hospital. The old father would not be put off. He cabled again to say he was coming all the way to Cape Town. In desperation, Brunt appealed to his friends in the Comintern, and the matter was arranged. They ran the old man down on a lonely road in the Mutseki Valley, did half a wheel change on his car, and made it look like a hit-and-run. After that, it was plain sailing. The young man could not get home for the funeral. Everyone at Duivelskloof understood that, and Lawyer Benson had no suspicion when he was asked to realize the estate and mail the proceeds to Cape Town. There was silence in the general's office, disturbed only by the buzzing of a fly on the window pane. The general nodded several times. "It makes sense," he conceded at last. "But there's no proof. We cannot prove the Brunts were not Jewish, let alone were communists. Can you give me anything that puts it beyond doubt?" Preston reached into his pocket and produced the photograph, which he laid on General Pienaar's desk. "That is a picture, the last picture, of the real Jan Murray. As you see, he was a useful cricketer in his boyhood. He was a bowler. If you look, you will see his fingers are gripping the ball in the manner of a spin bowler. You will also see he is left-handed. I have spent a week studying Jan Murray in London, at close range, through binoculars. In driving, smoking, eating, drinking, he is right-handed. General, you can do many things to a man to change him. You can change his hair, his speech, his face, his mannerisms, but you cannot turn a left-handed spin bowler into a right-handed man." General Pienaar, who had played cricket for half of his life, stared down at the photograph. "So, what have we got up there in London, Mr. Preston? General, you have got a dedicated communist agent who has worked inside the South African Foreign Service more than 40 years for the Soviet Union." General Pienaar lifted his eyes from the desk and gazed out across the valley to the Voortrekker monument. "I'll break him," he whispered. "I'll break him into tiny pieces and stamp them into the Bosveld." Preston coughed. "Bearing in mind that we also have a problem because of this man, could I ask you to restrain your hand until you have talked personally to Sir Nigel Irvin?" "Very well, Mr. Preston," General Pienaar nodded. "I will talk to Sir Nigel first. Now, what are your plans?" "There is a flight back to London this evening, sir. I'd like to be on it." General Pienaar rose and held out his hand. "Good day, Mr. Preston. Captain Fulion will see you to the plane. And thank you for your assistance." From the hotel, as he packed, Preston made a call to Dennis Gray, who drove up from Johannesburg and took a message for coded transmission to London. He had his answer 2 hours later. Sir Bernard Hemmings would come into the office the next day, Saturday, to meet him. Preston and Fulion stood in the departure lounge just before 8 p.m. as the last calls for passengers on the South African Airways flight for London were made. Preston showed his boarding pass and Fulion his all-purpose ID card. They went through to the cooler darkness of the tarmac.
"I'll say this for you, Engelsmann. You're a damned good Jachhund."
"Thank you," said Preston.
"Do you know what a Jachhund is?"
I believe, said Preston carefully, that the Cape hunting dog is slow, ungainly, and very tenacious. It was the first time that week that Captain Fulleun threw back his head and laughed. Then he grew serious. May I ask you something?
Yes.
Why did you put a flower on the old man's grave?
Preston stared across at the waiting airliner, its cabin lights blaring in the semi-darkness 20 yards away. The last passengers were climbing the steps.
They had taken away his son, he said, and then they killed him to stop him finding out. It seemed the thing to do.
Fulleun held out his hand.
Goodbye, John, and good luck.
Goodbye, Andries. 10 minutes later, the flying springbok on the fin of the jetliner tilted its straining nose towards the sky and lifted off for the north and Europe. Chapter 11. Sir Bernard Hemmings, with Brian Harcourt-Smith by his side, sat in silence and listened to Preston's report until he had finished.
Good God, he said heavily when Preston was silent. So it was Moscow, after all. There'll be the devil to pay. The damage must have been huge. Brian, are both men still under surveillance?
Yes, Sir Bernard.
Keep it that way through the weekend. Make no move to close in until the Paragon Committee have had a chance to hear what we have. John, I know you must be tired, but can you have your report written up by Sunday night?
Yes, sir.
Then have it on my desk first thing Monday morning. I'll reach the various committee members at their homes and ask for an urgent meeting for Monday morning.
When Major Valery Piotrowski was shown into the sitting room of the elegant dacha at Usova, he was in a spirit of extreme trepidation. He had never met the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, nor ever imagined he would do so. He had had a confusing, even terrifying, 3 days. Since being seconded to special duties by his own director, he had been sequestered in a flat in central Moscow, guarded night and day by 2 men from the 9th Directorate, the Kremlin Guards. Not unnaturally, he had feared the worst, without having the faintest idea what he was supposed to have done. Then the abrupt order that Sunday evening to dress in his best suit of civilian clothes and follow the guards downstairs to a waiting chaika, followed by the silent drive to Usova. He did not even recognize the dacha to which he was brought. It was only when Major Pavlov had told him, "The Comrade General Secretary will see you now," that he had realized where he was. His throat was dry as he stepped through the door into the sitting room. He tried to compose himself, telling himself he would answer any accusations levelled at him respectfully and truthfully. Inside the door he stood rigidly to attention. The old man in the wheelchair observed him silently for several minutes, then raised a hand and beckoned him forward. Piotrowski took 4 smart steps and stopped again, still to attention. But when the Soviet leader spoke, the whiplash of accusation in his voice was missing. He spoke quite softly.
"Major Piotrowski, you are not a tailor's dummy. Come forward into the light where I can see you, and sit down."
Piotrowski was stunned. To be seated in the presence of the General Secretary was, for a young major, unheard of. He did as he was told, perching on the edge of the indicated chair, back stiff, knees together.
"Have you any idea why I have sent for you?"
"No, Comrade General Secretary. No, I suppose not. It was necessary that no one knew. Then I will tell you. There is a mission that has to be performed. Its outcome will be of quite incalculable importance to the Soviet Union and the victory of the revolution. If it succeeds, the benefits to our country will be inestimable. If it fails, the damage to us will be catastrophic. I have personally chosen you, Valery Alexeyevich, to accomplish that mission."
Piotrowski's mind whirled. His original fear that he was destined to disgrace and exile was replaced by an almost uncontrollable jubilation. Ever since, as a brilliant scholar at Moscow University, he had been plucked from an intended career in the Foreign Ministry to become one of the first Chief Directorate's bright young men. Ever since he had volunteered for and been accepted by the elite Illegals Directorate, he had dreamed of an impossible mission, but his wildest dreams had not encompassed anything like this.
He allowed himself at last to look the General Secretary straight in the eye. Thank you, Comrade General Secretary. Others will brief you as to the details, the General Secretary continued. Time will be short, but you have already been trained to the peak of your abilities, and you will have all for the mission that you need. I have asked to see you personally for one reason. There is something that must be put to you, and I have chosen to put it myself. If the mission succeeds, and I have no doubt it will, you will return here to promotion and honours beyond your imaginings. I will see to it. But if anything should go wrong, if the police and troops of the country to which you will be sent are seen to be closing in, you will have to take steps without hesitation to ensure that you are not taken alive. Do you understand, Valery Alexievich? Yes, I do, Comrade General Secretary. To be taken alive, to be rigorously interrogated, to be broken. Oh, yes, it is possible nowadays. There are no reserves of courage that can resist the chemicals. To be paraded before an international press conference, all this would be a living hell anyway. But the damage of such a spectacle to the Soviet Union, to this, your country, would be beyond estimation and beyond repair. Major Piotrowski took a deep breath. I will not fail, he said. But if it comes to it, I will never be taken alive. The General Secretary pressed a buzzer beneath the table, and the door opened. Major Pavlov stood there. Go then, young man. You will be told here in this house by a man whom you have seen before what the mission involves. Then you will go to another place for intensive briefing. We will not meet again until you return. When the door closed upon the two majors of the KGB, the General Secretary stared for a long time into the flickering flames of the log fire. Such a fine young man, he thought. Such a pity. As Piotrowski followed the back of Major Pavlov down two long corridors to the guest wing, he felt as if his rib cage could hardly contain the emotions of expectation and pride within it. Major Valery Alexievich Piotrowski was a dyed-in-the-wool Russian soldier and patriot. Steeped in the English language, he had heard the phrase, to die for God, king, and country, and he understood its meaning. He had no god, but he had been personally entrusted by the leader of his country, and he was determined, as he walked down that corridor at Usovo, that if the moment should ever come, he would not shrink from what had to be done. Major Pavlov stopped at a door, knocked, and pushed it open. He stood aside to let Piotrowski enter. Then he closed the door and withdrew. A white-haired man rose from a chair by a table covered in notes and maps, and came forward. So, you are Major Piotrowski, he smiled, holding out his hand. Piotrowski was surprised by the stutter. He knew the face, though they had never met. In the folklore of the FCD, this man was, younger entrants were taught, one of the five stars, a man to be respected, a man who represented one of the great triumphs of Soviet ideology over capitalism. Yes, Comrade Colonel, he said. Philby had read the file until he knew it perfectly. Piotrowski was still only 36 and had been trained for a decade to pass for an Englishman. He had twice been in Britain on familiarization trips, each time living under deep cover, each time going nowhere near the Soviet embassy, and neither time undertaking any mission at all. These familiarization trips were simply to enable illegals, before they went operational, to acclimatize themselves to everything they would one day see again. Simple things, opening a bank account, having a scrape with another car driver and knowing what to do, using the London Underground, and always improving the use of modern slang phrases. Philby knew the young man in front of him not only spoke perfect English, but was tone perfect in four regional accents, and had faultless command of Welsh and Irish. He dropped into English himself. "Sit down," he said. "Now I am simply going to describe to you the broad outlines of the mission. Others will give you all the details. Time will be short, desperately short, so you will have to absorb everything faster than ever in your life before." As they talked, Philby realized that after 30 years away from his native land, and despite reading every newspaper and magazine from Britain that he could lay his hands on, it was he who was out of practice, whose phraseology was stilted and old-fashioned. The young Russian spoke like a modern Englishman of his age. It took 2 hours for Philby to outline the plan called Aurora, and what it involved.
Pietrovsky drank in the details. He was excited and amazed by the audacity of it.
You will spend the next few days with a team of 4 men only. They will brief you on a whole range of names, places, dates, transmission times, rendezvous, and backup rendezvous. You will memorize them all. The only thing you will have to take in with you will be a block of one-time pads.
Well, that's it.
Pietrovsky sat nodding at what he had been told.
I have told the Comrade General Secretary I shall not fail, he said. It will be done, as required, and on time. If the components arrive, it will be done.
Philby rose.
Good. Then I will have you driven back to Moscow, to the place where you will spend the remaining time until your departure.
As Philby crossed the room to the internal phone, Pietrovsky was startled by a loud coo from the corner. He looked to see a large cage in which a handsome pigeon with a splint on one leg was regarding them. Philby turned with an apologetic grin. I call him Hopalong, he said, as he dialed for Major Pavlov to return. Found him in the street last winter with a broken wing and leg. The wing has mended, but the leg keeps giving trouble. Pietrovsky crossed to the cage and scratched the bars with a fingernail, but the pigeon waddled away to the far side. The door opened to admit Major Pavlov. As usual, he said nothing, but gestured to Pietrovsky to follow him. Until we meet again. Good luck, said Philby. The members of the Paragon Committee sat and read Preston's report until the last one had finished.
So, said Sir Anthony Plum to open the discussion, now at least we know what, where, when, and who. We still don't know why. Nor how much, interposed Sir Patrick Strickland. The damage assessment is still unattempted, and we have simply got to inform our allies, even though nothing sensitive, save for one fictitious paper, has gone on its way to Moscow since January.
Agreed, said Sir Anthony. All right, gentlemen, I think we must concur the time for further investigation is over. How do we handle this man? Any ideas? Brian.
Brian Harcourt-Smith was without his Director General and represented MI5 alone. He chose his words carefully. We take the view that with Berenson, Marais, and the cutout Benotti, the ring is complete. It seems to the Security Service that it is unlikely there were more agents being run by this one ring. Berenson would have been so important, it seems to us likely the entire ring was set up to handle him alone. There were nods of agreement round the table.
And your recommendation? Asked Sir Anthony.
That we pick them all up. Roll up the whole ring, said Harcourt Smith.
And there's a foreign diplomat involved, objected Sir Hubert Villiers of the Home Office.
I think Pretoria may be prepared to waive immunity in this case, said Sir Patrick Strickland. General Pinard must have reported all this to Mr. Botha by now. They'll no doubt want Marais when we have had a chat to him.
Well, that seems decisive enough, said Sir Anthony. How about you, Nigel?
Sir Nigel Irvine had been staring at the ceiling as if lost in thought. At the question, he seemed to wake up.
I was just wondering, he said quietly. We pick them up.
Then what?
Interrogation, said Harcourt Smith. We can begin damage assessment and inform our allies of the roundup of the entire ring to sweeten the pill a bit.
Yes, said Sir Nigel, it's good. But what after that?
He began to address the secretaries of the 3 ministries and the cabinet.
It seems to me we have 4 choices. We can pick up Berenson and formally charge him under the Official Secrets Act, which we'll have to do if we arrest him. But do we actually have a case that will stand up in court? We know we're right, but can we prove it against a first-class legal defence? Apart from anything else, a formal arrest and charge would cause a major scandal, which would be certain to rebound against the government. Sir Martin Flannery, the Cabinet Secretary, took the point. Unlike anyone else in the room, he knew of the intention to hold a snap summer election because the Prime Minister had told him in strictest confidence. A lifelong civil servant of the old school, Sir Martin offered his total loyalty to the present government, as he had to 3 previous governments, 2 of them Labour. He would offer that same loyalty to any democratically elected successor government.
He pursed his lips.
Then, resumed Sir Nigel, we could leave Berenson and Marais in place, but seek to feed Berenson doctored documents to pass on to Moscow. But that wouldn't work for long.
Berenson is too highly placed and knowledgeable to be fooled by that. Sir Peregrine Jones nodded. He knew that on that point Sir Nigel was right. Or we could pick Berenson up and try to get his complete cooperation in damage assessment by an immunity from prosecution deal. Personally, I hate immunity for traitors. You never know whether they've told you the whole truth or tricked you, as Blunt did, and it always gets out eventually with an even worse scandal. Sir Hubert Villiers, whose ministry contained the law officers of the Crown, frowned in agreement. He, too, hated immunity deals, and they all knew the Prime Minister felt the same. "That seems to leave," said the Chief of the SIS smoothly, "the question of detention without trial and rigorous interrogation, in a word, third degree. I suppose I'm just old-fashioned, but I've never had much confidence in it. He might admit to 50 documents, but we'd none of us know to the day we died if there wasn't another 50. There was silence for a while. "They're all pretty unpleasant," agreed Sir Anthony Plum. "But it looks as if we'll have to go with Brian's suggestion, if there aren't any others."
"There might just be one," said Sir Nigel gently. "It could be, you know, that Berenson's recruitment was a genuine false flag approach."
Most of those present knew what a false flag recruitment was, but Sir Hubert Villiers of the Home Office and Sir Martin Flannery of the Cabinet frowned in puzzlement. Sir Nigel explained.
"It involves the recruitment of a source by men who pretend to be working for one country, with whom the subject is sympathetic, while in reality they are working for another. The Israeli Mossad are particular experts at this technique. Being able to produce agents who can pass for just about any nation under the sun, the Israelis have worked some remarkable stings with false flags. For example, a loyal West German working in the Middle East is approached while on furlough in Germany by two fellow Germans, who, with impeccable supporting evidence, prove to him that they represent the BND, the West German intelligence arm. They spin him a tale to the effect that the French, working on the same project in Iraq, are passing on technology secrets that are patently forbidden by NATO. They are doing this to secure greater commercial orders. Would the German help his own country by reporting back what is going on? As a loyal German, he agrees and spends years working for Jerusalem. It has happened many times. It makes sense, you know," pursued Sir Nigel. "We've all been through Berenson's file until we are no doubt sick of it. But with what we now know, the false flag technique could be the answer."
There were several nods as they recalled the contents of Berenson's file. He had started his career in the Foreign Office, straight out of university. He had progressed quite well, serving abroad on three occasions and rising steadily, if not spectacularly, in the diplomatic corps. In the mid-60s, he had married Lady Fiona Glenn, and shortly afterwards had been posted to Pretoria, accompanied by his wife. It was probably there, confronted by the traditional and almost limitless South Africa hospitality, that he had developed his deep sympathy and admiration for South Africa. With a Labour government in power in Britain and Rhodesia in rebellion, his increasingly outspoken admiration of Pretoria had not gone down very well. On his return to Britain in 1969, word had apparently reached him that his next posting was likely to be somewhere less controversial, say, Bolivia. The men round the table could only surmise, but it was perfectly likely that Lady Fiona, while prepared to take Pretoria in her stride, had put her foot down flatly at the idea of leaving her beloved horses and social life to spend 3 years halfway up the Andes. Whatever had been the reason, George Berenson had applied for a transfer to defence, regarded as going down market, but with his wife's fortune he should care. With the constraints of the Foreign Office removed from him, he had become a member of several pro-South African friendship societies, usually the preserve of those politically of the right wing. Sir Peregrine Jones, at least, knew that Berenson's known and too overt right-wing sympathies had made it impossible for him, Jones, to recommend Berenson for a knighthood, something he now realized might well have fueled Berenson's resentment. Since reading the report an hour earlier, the senior civil servants had assumed Berenson's pro-South African sympathies to be the cover of a secret Soviet sympathizer. Now Sir Nigel Irvine's suggestion had put a different cast on things again. "A false flag," mused Sir Paddy Strickland. "You mean he really thought he was passing secrets to South Africa?"
"I am seized by this enigma," said C.
If he was a secret Soviet sympathizer, or closet communist all along, why didn't the center run him with a Soviet controller? I can think of five in their embassy who could have done the job equally well.
I confess I don't know, said Sir Arthur Plum.
At that moment he glanced up and looked down the table, catching Sir Nigel Irvine's eye. Irvine dropped one eyelid quickly down and then back up again. Sir Anthony Plum forced his gaze back to the Berenson file in front of him.
You cunning bastard, Nigel, he thought. You're not speculating at all. You actually know.
In fact, Andreev had reported something 2 days earlier. It was not much, just canteen scuttlebutt from inside the Soviet embassy. He had been drinking with the Line N man and discussing tradecraft in general. He had mentioned the usefulness on occasion of false flag recruitment. The illegals directorate representative had laughed, winked, and tapped the side of his nose with a forefinger. Andreev took the gesture to mean that there was a false flag operation going on in London at that moment, of which the Line N man knew something. Sir Nigel, when he heard, took the same view. Another thought occurred to Sir Anthony.
If you really do know, Nigel, it must be because you have a source right inside their residentura. You old fox.
Then another thought occurred, and it was less pleasant.
Why not say so outright?
They were all completely reliable around that table, were they not? A cold worm of unease stirred inside him. He looked up.
Well, I think we should seriously consider Nigel's suggestion. It does make sense. What have you in mind, Nigel?
The man's a traitor, no doubt about that, said C. If he's presented with the documents that were anonymously returned to us, I've no doubt he'll be pretty shaken. But if he's then given John Preston's South Africa file to read, and he did think he was working for Pretoria, I don't think he'll be able to mask his collapse. If he was a secret communist all along, he'll know of Marais's ideology anyway, so it won't come as a surprise to him. I think a trained observer should be able to tell.
And if it was a false flag approach, asked Sir Perry Jones, then I think we'll get his complete and unstinted cooperation in damage assessment. More, I think he could be persuaded to turn voluntarily, enabling us to mount a major disinformation operation against Moscow. Now that we could take to our allies as a big plus.
Sir Paddy Strickland of the Foreign Office was won over.
It was agreed to pursue Sir Nigel's tactic. One last thing. Who goes to see him? Asked Sir Anthony.
Sir Nigel Irvine coughed. Well, of course it's really down to five, he said, but a disinformation operation against the centre would be for six to handle. Then again, I happen to know the man. Actually, we were at school together.
Good Lord, exclaimed Plum. He's a bit younger than you, isn't he?
5 years, actually. He used to clean my boots.
All right. Are we agreed? Anyone against? You've got it, Nigel. You take him. He's yours.
Tell us how you get on.
On Tuesday the 24th, a South African tourist arrived from Johannesburg at London's Heathrow Airport, where he passed through the formalities without difficulty. As he emerged from the customs hall carrying his own grip, a young man moved forward and murmured a question in his ear. The burly South African nodded in confirmation. The younger man took his grip and led him outside to a waiting car. Instead of heading towards London, the driver took the M25 Ring Road and then the M3 towards Hampshire. An hour later, it drew up in front of the door of a handsome country house outside Basingstoke. The South African, relieved of his coat, was ushered into the library. From a seat by the fire, an Englishman in country tweeds and of the same age rose to greet him.
"Henry Pinar, how good to see you again. It's been too long. Welcome to England."
"Nigel, how have you been keeping?"
The heads of the two intelligence services had an hour before lunch was called, so after the usual preliminaries they settled down to discuss the problem that had brought General Pinar to the country house maintained by the SIS for the hospitality of notable but clandestine guests.